U.S. Senator Angus King on the unfolding news out of Washington. As a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Angus King is in the thick of the controversy over alleged Russian influence in the election and possible contacts between Russian intelligence and President Trump's staff. He says he'll be meeting with ousted National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and others as part of the investigation. Meantime, King has so far voted for all but four of Trump's cabinet nominees, voting against Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary, Jeff Sessions for Attorney General, Steven Mnuchin for Treasury, and Tom Price as head of Health and Human Services. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, it is your chance to ask U.S. Senator Angus King about his priorities 27 days into the Trump administration. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yesterday, Senator Angus King posted a selfie on his official Senate Facebook page, a photo of him in a Senate elevator that had gotten stuck. The senator quipped that he bet the Russians were behind it. Senator King is no longer in that elevator, but rather in a studio on Capitol Hill to talk about the latest news out of Washington. King serves on the Senate Rules and Administration Committee, the Select Committee on Intelligence, the Armed Services Committee, the Budget Committee, and the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Senator Angus King? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post the Maine Calling Facebook page. Hello, Senator King. Thanks so much for joining us.
Jennifer, it's great to join you. And before we start, I have to tell you that every Wednesday morning, as you probably know, we have a coffee and wonderful blueberry cake for anybody from Maine that's in Washington at the office. And yesterday, your son Sam showed up, who's in college down here, and it was great to have him down here. He met some of the staff, and I can report that he looked good, and he's doing his homework, and he seems to be enjoying his college.
He did. He's been looking forward to going to one of your Wednesday morning events. He was happy that it wasn't so crowded that he actually got a chance to say hi to you and to Mary Herman. But yeah, Sam is really taking advantage of life in Washington, D.C., going to see lots of speakers and spending time in lots of museums and now getting to meet you. So that was really terrific.
And I'm glad I don't have to report from the elevator. John Tester was with me. It was there were about 10 people. Nobody could move. It was just like in a movie, and it was getting hotter and hotter, and I was pushing the button periodically. The funny part was John Tester called his office. He had his phone, and he kept telling them that he was in a stuck elevator, and they thought he was kidding. He couldn't get anybody to take him seriously.
Oh, my goodness.
So finally a guy came and pried the doors open, but it was one of those funny experiences. The only thing I could think of was, thank goodness it wasn't an elevator. We were coming away from a vote. What if Susan Collins had been in the elevator going to a vote? I mean, then we would have really had it.
That's true. And there have got to be some analogies in this idea that U.S. senators stuck in an elevator and no one believes them. So we'll have to think about something. But, you know, happy to hear you're out of the elevator. We're talking to you as really, really, really serious and unnerving things are swirling about Capitol Hill. And I want to start with your service on the Senate Intelligence Committee. The Intelligence Committee is going to be investigating alleged Russian influence in the election and on the president's staff. What is the range and scope of that investigation?
Well, it's pretty broad. We worked together with Richard Burr, who's the chair, and Mark Warner, who's the ranking Democrat on the committee. And the scope is, what did the Russians do? What were their motives? And how did they go about it? That's number one. But this was a month or 6 weeks ago when we were talking about what the scope of the investigation would be. And also one of the questions was, what contacts were there during the campaign between either of the campaigns and the Russians? And naturally, in the last few days, that has become a much more relevant question. So we'll be looking into all aspects of it. And this, by the way, Susan Collins is also on the Intelligence Committee. It's a committee of only of 15. There are 8 Republicans and 6 Democrats and me. So it's 8-7 in that sense. And It is a very heavy responsibility. I take it. I told somebody yesterday, I think it may be the most important work of my life because this is such a serious matter.
A lot of people are angry about the leaks. President Trump has said that he is going to find out who the leakers are. Are you worried that intelligence officers will be hesitant to talk to the Intelligence Committee out of fear of reprisal?
Well, I don't think so, because if they're talking to us, that's not a leak. That's they're just doing their duty. We deal with classified information all the time. We deal with people from the intelligence community all the time. I'm concerned about leaks as well. I think that's a very reasonable question that needs to be pursued. But that's a separate inquiry from what happened. I think the two things are both important, and we shouldn't get diverted by saying, "Well, these leaks are terrible," and ignore what the substance of the issue is. So I think those are two things that need to be looked into. The other piece is, of course, nobody knows where the leaks came from. We know that the White House had the information about General Flynn for the last almost 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks before the announcement of his resignation. And so that we know then that the intelligence community had some of this information, the Justice Department had the information, and the Trump White House had this information. And as you know, we've learned in the last couple of weeks that the White House hasn't exactly been hermetically sealed when it comes to leaks. So one of the questions is, where did they come from? Did it come from the intelligence community, or did it come from Justice or the White House? So that's a perfectly legitimate issue. I'm concerned about it as well. But I'm equally or more so concerned about the Russians trying to manipulate our electoral process.
Will the committee issue a subpoena for the president's tax records looking for links to Russia?
I doubt that. I haven't. That hasn't really been discussed. I think we're more interested in starting with Michael Flynn and then other people that were involved in the campaign. We do have subpoena power. And certainly my goal is to keep this investigation as open as possible and also as bipartisan as possible. Ironically, what we're seeing the Russians up to here is absolutely consistent with what they're doing in other parts of the world. At this very moment, they're engaged I don't know what the formal term would be, messing around with the elections in Germany and France that are coming up later this year. I was in the Ukraine and Poland with members of the Intelligence Committee last winter, and we were told then that the Russians are absolutely have a very sophisticated strategy for undermining democratic norms and processes in those countries. And then later this fall, I met with people from Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, and they said the same thing, that this is what the Russians do. So what we're seeing, what they did here is not unusual and it's not out of character. But interestingly, the people in the Baltic states, when I said, how do you prevent this? You can't shut down your TV. You can't shut down your internet. They said the best prevention is for the public to know that it's happening. In other words, for them to understand that the Russians do this and they can sort of shrug it off. And you have some of this fake news and disinformation. People say, oh, yeah, that's just the Russians. So that's why I think we need to understand this and the public needs to understand what the Russians are up to, because 2016 isn't going to be the last time they do this. If other countries are any indication, they're going to keep poking around and trying to undermine confidence in our electoral process and democracy. And so it's something that's what makes it so serious. We've never had anything like this.
Just this morning, you voted against the president's nominee for the Office of Management and Budget, bringing the number of nominations that you voted against to 5, if my math is correct. I'm sure you've heard from constituents who wish that number were larger. Senator King, how do you make your decisions, especially your vote for Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State?
Well, I try to take them. The first point is I try to take them one at a time and not make a blanket judgment. I think I've now voted for 7 or 8, maybe 9 of the nominees, voted against 5 or 6, as you mentioned. I'll certainly vote against Scott Pruitt sometime either later today or tomorrow morning. you know, it's funny. As a former governor, I sort of start with a premise that the executive should be able to pick their own people, and that, you know, that should be you should sort of start it at yes. But I have to draw the line when you have a candidate who basically is fundamentally opposed to the mission of the agency to which they're being appointed. Scott Pruitt at EPA, I mean, as near as I can tell, I've never seen anything in his record, and I went to his hearing, even though I'm not on the committee. I've seen nothing in his record that indicates the slightest interest in environmental protection. And, in fact, just the opposite. His whole career as Attorney General in Oklahoma has been to attack environmental laws, to sue the Environmental Protection Agency. And that doesn't mean that the EPA is perfect or some of their regulations don't need correction, but to be sort of fundamentally opposed to the mission of the agency, I just couldn't go along with. Same with Betsy DeVos at Education. Rex Tillerson was a tough call for me. And because I'm very strong, as you know, on climate change, and I'm very leery of his record at ExxonMobil and the relationship with Russia and those things. On the other hand, I was very anxious to get somebody of mature judgment close to the president on foreign policy issues. And, you know, to put it most bluntly, I'd rather have Rex Tillerson advising him than Steve Bannon. And that was the choice as I faced it. And I think the proof was that in this travel ban that I think was ill-advised and ill-drafted and just not very well executed, Mr. Tillerson had no role, neither did General Mattis or General Kelly. They were sort of outside of that. Since Tillerson has come on, we've seen the president walk back some of his positions on China and other areas. So it was really a question of wanting to get somebody with good judgment. I consulted with some very senior people that I outside of government who know him, who I respect, who were very supportive. It wasn't an easy call, but I don't get to vote for a piece. I can't vote for the judgment part and against the Exxon part. I did tell him. I met with him and asked him a lot of detailed questions, but I said, you sure would have made my job easier if you'd been president of Procter & Gamble instead of ExxonMobil. I couldn't vote for a piece of him. I had to vote for one or the other. And, of course, the other question that's always in the background, if not him, who? And it might be somebody who I believe would be much worse. So that was probably the toughest call that I've had thus far, but I don't have any real apologies for it. I wished he hadn't, had the connections with Russia. On the other hand, he's got true international experience. He's a man of character. And on the climate change part, since he became the chief executive officer of ExxonMobil, they have changed their position on climate change. Now, whether that was public relations or whether it was a genuine understanding of the science, I don't know, but in any case, it was wanting to get grown-up into that foreign policy format that really motivated my vote.
You mentioned that you will vote against EPA nominee Scott Pruitt, as will Senator Collins. Will he make it through? Do you believe he has the votes to make it through anyway?
I think he probably will. My guess is the vote will be 51-49. That was the vote this morning on Mr. Mulvaney for Office of Management and Budget. John McCain voted against Mulvaney. I haven't heard of any other Republicans that are planning to vote against Pruitt, so it'll be essentially a party line vote minus Susan. And by the way, she should be. It takes some guts to do that. A friend once told me it's pretty easy to stand up to your enemies. It's hard to stand up to your friends. And for her to be the sole vote or of one or two votes in her caucus, that's pretty hard. But again, I just don't understand putting somebody in. Dr. Price, the same way. I voted against him. He wants to privatize Medicare, block grant Medicaid, and repeal the Affordable Care Act. The name of the department is Health and Human Services, and all of those things are the antithesis of Health and Human Services. So That was a pretty easy vote, as is Scott Pruitt. I think, as I say, the hardest one that I've had thus far is Rex Tillerson. I worked on it hard. I did a lot of homework, talked to a lot of people who know him, went to his hearing in person, even though I'm not on the committee, and then met him in person and ultimately decided that, as I say, I think it would be better for the country to have him in that position than not.
Senator King, have you met with Judge Neil Gorsuch yet, the Supreme Court nominee?
I have not. It's scheduled, I think, for week after next. I haven't met him. We're collecting his opinions. I'm going to read them. I'm going to meet with him. I'll go to his hearing and listen to his testimony. Everybody that's talked to him has come away impressed by his intelligence and capability, but I want to try to get a feel for his judicial philosophy and what kind of judge he will be. I really am not going to predict now. I don't think it's appropriate to say I'm 100% against him when I haven't read his opinions or met with him. So I'm going to, as I say, I try to take him one at a time and listen and learn and do my homework and come to a conclusion that I think will be in the best interests of Maine and the country.
Tell me about the bill that you, Rob Portman, and Chris Coons just introduced yesterday to end the student loan tax penalty for families suffering from a child's death or permanent disability. What's going on now and what needs to be changed?
Oh, this is just a terrible piece of law that came to our attention. There's a couple in Topsom, Don and Nora Brennan. Their son died in 2012, Keegan, unexpectedly, a brain aneurysm. He'd gone to school. He had student loans. And there's a provision of federal law that if you die if you're totally disabled, your student loan is discharged, so you don't have to pay the loan. However, under the tax laws, if a loan is discharged, that's taxable to you or the parent as if it's income. So all of a sudden, these parents who are devastated by the loss of their son are presented by a tens of thousands of dollar bill from the IRS for taxes owed, and the same from the state of Maine. So Rob Portman, who's a Republican senator from Ohio, Chris Coons from Delaware, and I agree that this is just terrible, unfair, and awful policy, have introduced this bill, and we're hoping that we can get it through. It's so straightforward, and I haven't found anybody yet who doesn't agree with us, that we can get it through without getting all bogged down in waiting for major tax reform or that kind of thing. And that's really what it basically says is if your student loans are discharged for total disability or death, you don't have to pay the taxes on the loan, and the parents don't have to pay the taxes on the loan. To me, that just again, that's just common sense. I'm hoping we have bipartisan support. We have bipartisan support in the House. And so I think this one may have a chance of going. I certainly hope so.
We're talking with Senator Angus King. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Seniors Plus, Western Maine's agency on aging. Critical services for older adults, disabled adults, and caregivers. SeniorsPlus.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mahershala Ali, who's nominated for an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor for his role in Moonlight, as a drug dealer who becomes the father figure to a young boy. Moonlight is nominated for Best Picture, and so is another film Ali co-stars in, Hidden Figures. He gave a very moving speech when accepting a Golden Globe last month for his performance in Moonlight. Join us.
Tune in to Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. The PBS NewsHour on Maine Public Television stands apart. It's news the way you want and expect your television news to be. Each evening at 7, a full hour of coverage. The top stories and issues of the day objectively explored and discussed in depth with differing viewpoints. News you can trust, with prominent guests and intelligent voices. The most important issues of the day from around the globe, all helping to make sense of our complicated and ever-changing world. The PBS NewsHour, at 7 weeknights on Maine Public Television and at 10 on the Maine Public Television World Channel.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Senator Angus King is on the line with us from a studio in our nation's capital. He is an independent, as everyone knows, serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee and three others. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with an email, Senator King. This is from Sarah, and she has caps for the word you. What can you do to hold Jeff Sessions and the Trump Department of Justice accountable for identifying and fighting voter suppression in all its different forms?
Well, the answer to the question is a little bit ironic. The first things that Jeff Sessions should do is recuse himself from any involvement in these matters. I happened to read yesterday the guidance within the Department of Justice for when there's a conflict of interest that should be you should recuse yourself, and it could have been written for this situation. It talks about being a political supporter, of being involved in politics and the campaign. And, of course, Jeff Sessions was a major campaigner for Donald Trump. I think he was his first supporter in the Senate. And I think there's very little question that he should recuse himself and not be involved in these decisions. I voted against him in part because, as we were talking about Rex Tillerson, I felt Rex Tillerson would be a person who would tell Donald Trump what he needs to hear, not what he wants to hear. I know Jeff Sessions. I've worked with him. I've served on the Armed Services Committee with him. But I wasn't confident that he would take that position. He would be more inclined to try to enable what the president wanted to do. It's important to remember the president has a counsel in the White House. That's his lawyer. The attorney general is the lawyer for all the rest of us. The attorney general is the lawyer for the people of the United States and not the lawyer for the president of the United States. So now, what can I do? Certainly continue to pay attention to these issues and try to push publicly and privately for Jeff Sessions to recuse himself. And through the work of the Intelligence Committee, I'm going to be right deeply involved in this investigation. We're going to have subpoena power, and I can assure you that we're going to go in as far as the facts lead us. And if I see it turning into partisan or some kind of cover-up or a whitewash, you're going to hear about it. I'll be very loud about my concerns. So right now I think we're off to a good start in the Intelligence Committee. We've identified the staff that's going to work on it, the documents, the first round of documents, where they are, who has custody, and we're starting to talk about who's going to be called as witnesses. So my role is going to be on the Intelligence Committee, being sure there is a full, fair, and thorough investigation of all aspects of this unprecedented Russian attempted intervention in our elections.
Thank you, Sarah, for your question. We're going to go up to Bangor and Sam. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on. Senator, I watched your speech on the floor of the Senate when you shared your story about your cancer, and I want to thank you for doing that. This is a really personal issue for me, too. I got really sick right after I graduated college and didn't have health insurance. And it wound up being, because I wasn't able to get a diagnosis, much less treatment, by the time I was able to get care, I was in really bad shape, and it was a really painful recovery and several surgeries, and it was just a horrible process that could have been almost entirely.
And that's the point that these folks miss, that are taking insurance away from people, that it literally saves lives. In my case, if I hadn't had insurance and hadn't had the checkup that was part of the insurance, I would not be here. And it sounds like you had a similar experience.
Absolutely. And my wife is actually in grad school right now, and she's only able to do that because the ACA allows her to have health insurance while she's going to school.
Sam, thank you.
Well,
thank you for your call.
Keep sounding off, Sam, because that's what we need.
And also on healthcare, we have an email from Sandy. Thank you for your principled positions and your willingness to always clearly state the reasons for your decisions. We are concerned about Medicare and, quote, premium support, which we assume is another way of saying vouchers. We think Medicare is currently one of the most effective and efficient government programs, and are frightfully concerned about the possibility of privatization. Can you please share your views with us?
Well, number one, you're absolutely right. Premium support is another word for vouchers, which is another word for shifting the cost of Medicare to seniors. I mean, that's just the fact. And you're right to be concerned because Tom Price, the guy that was just confirmed last week for Secretary of Health and Human Services, is a big fan of vouchers, as is Paul Ryan in the House. And what they're doing basically, that what they say is, well, we're going to give you a voucher and you can buy your health, you know, to a senior now. Remember, you were talking about a senior. Think of your 80-year-old mother. Here's a voucher. You can buy insurance wherever you want. And here's what it amounts to. But if there's any difference between what the insurance costs and what the voucher is, you got to pay the difference. And the voucher amount would increase probably at the rate of inflation. Let's call it 1 or 2% a year, whereas healthcare inflation has been 5 or 6 or 7% a year. So as time goes by, the gap between what the voucher covers and the cost of the care is only going to get greater. On the floor of the Senate, I call this shift and shaft. This is shifting the cost from the government to seniors, and it's shafting the seniors. And frankly, I mean, I guess I understand it. It's going to make the government's books look a little bit better, but it's going to make seniors' books look a lot worse. It's a terrible idea. There are things we can do to improve Medicare, to improve the efficiency, but this isn't one of them. This is really, I think, driven by ideology. These are folks that don't like government programs, even ones that work. And Medicare has been one of the most successful government programs ever, and it's kept generations of seniors out of the horrible debt that would otherwise be the case. Final point on it that I think is really important. Medicare deals with the dollars and cents, but it also is peace of mind for seniors. It's one less thing that you have to worry about. And to suddenly put them back on the burden back on them of worrying about the cost of health care. Do I call the doctor? Do I go to the clinic? Do I go to the hospital? You know, how am I going to handle this? I just think is unconscionable. These are folks that have been paying into Medicare all their working life, and it should be left to run as it is. And one of my favorite main sayings is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I think there are things we can do with Medicare to improve it, but we certainly don't need to do this.
We'll go to Sophia, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Sophia. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. Senator King, as a 65-year-old American citizen, nothing has upset me more than this connection with Russia and what is happening with that. And I am concerned. I know that you all on the Intelligence Committee will try your best to get to the bottom of it. I'm concerned that the Republicans will not allow that to happen, and I'm more concerned that what you find out, we will not find out, that it will be basically kept behind closed doors. And I'm wondering if a joint committee, a select committee like after 9/11, Jane Harman of the Woodrow Wilson Center, a person I really respect and admire, suggested that as a way that more of the information would actually get out to the American public. And I think many of us are very alarmed by this. There is some reason.
Okay, Sophia, so you'd like a separate committee to try to figure out what could be released to the general public without violating intelligence secrets. And Senator King, what do you think of that idea?
Well, it's a very legitimate question. I think we need to start with the Intelligence Committee, number one, because this is the business we're in, which is overseeing the intelligence community. We're used to dealing with classified information. All of our staff have clearances. We have clearances. And to set up a new outside commission of some kind, it would take a fair amount of time to go through that process. And I think the key point that Sophia made is that it should be public. And I agree. There's no reason that the Intelligence Committee's proceedings have to be behind closed doors unless there is sensitive intelligence information that needs to remain classified. And that would be the case no matter who was doing the investigation, whether it was a Blue Ribbon Commission or another committee of the Congress. So I'm certainly going to be pressing that as much of it should be public as possible. As I mentioned, I think it's really important for the people of the United States to know what's going on here, and that's going to be my position as we move through. The other thing, I just to provide a little reassurance, the Intelligence Committee is 8-7, including me, and it's very carefully balanced. And on the Republican side are people like Susan Collins of Maine, Roy Blunt of Missouri, and Marco Rubio of Florida, who's been very strong on this issue, very critical of this Russian tie, and really seems to get it. So that provides me, in other words, if one of those refuses to go along with some kind of party effort to block things, that would be a majority in the other direction. The other thing that's reassuring is that the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the ranking minority member are ex officio members of the Intelligence Committee, and the chairman of the Armed Services Committee is none other than John McCain, who, as you know, pretty much goes his own way no matter what. So he's going to be involved in this process, and that gives me some reassurance. On the other hand, I think it's important that it not be turned into some kind of partisan witch hunt on the Democratic side. It should be fair and thorough and based on the facts, and it should be made as much of the information that doesn't compromise how the intelligence is collected should be made public to the American people.
Sophia, thanks so much for your question. We have a question from Margaret on Facebook, which I'm going to edit as I read because it's long. She's concerned about the president's lack of, she believes, no diplomacy, his understanding of global relations. She writes, are you worried about our global reputation due to what seems to be a number of mistakes in diplomacy by our president? Can you reassure us that this country is just as safe as it was 1 month ago? And how is the Congress helping to ensure that the president doesn't spin out of control any more than he already has?
Well, I'm going to avoid the can you reassure us because I'm concerned myself. And it goes back to some of the things I was talking about with Rex Tillerson. I think the best thing that the Congress can do is to try as hard as we can to be sure he has people around him and in his cabinet who will tell him the truth and who will argue with him and differ with him and educate him, frankly. I am concerned about the question that you raise. For example, the press conference yesterday on Israel, I've spent a lot of time on both intelligence and armed services. I've been to Israel, been to Jordan, Turkey, the surrounding countries, Lebanon, been to the West Bank, met with Palestinians, with Israelis. It is a very delicate and dangerous situation. And the president's press conference yesterday, where he sort of cavalierly said, well, I don't know whether it's two states or one state. I mean, this is very important, profound, has huge implications in the region. That it was really disturbing to me that it appeared to me, as anyway, watching that press conference, that he either hadn't been briefed or didn't care, and that's of concern. He's also talked about moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is very popular in some quarters, but would absolutely inflame the situation in the West Bank and would be very difficult for our allies in the region, our Arab and Muslim allies like Jordan. King Abdullah has made it clear, and he's probably our best ally in the region, he and Israel, that this would be a disaster from their point of view. So I think they're slowing down now on the moving of the embassy. And he did at least talk about the fact that the settlements could be a problem in the West Bank. So hopefully we're going to see a little bit of restraint. And again, that's why I think it's important to get people like General Mattis, who's a very solid guy, voted for him without hesitation in the Defense Department, General Kelly at Homeland Security, Rex Tillerson, to get a foreign policy team together that has some experience and maturity. Because Mr. Trump does not have this kind of experience, and he's going to need people around him who can say, wait a minute, you can't just go on your instinct here. There's too much at stake.
We're going to try to squeak in one more call before our next break, and hopefully it's a very short one. Hi, James in South Portland.
Hi, Senator King. Hey, I've heard you speak before, and I'm listening to the show today. My question for you is, how's Iran for 2020 looking.
For which office, James?
For the big office, for the president office. King, would you run for president is the question. For 2020.
There's an old saying in the good book, James, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. And what that means is I've got enough problems as it is. I appreciate the thought, but my intention is to keep serving the people of Maine. I like you. Thank you, though.
Thanks for the question, James.
That.
And I like how you phrased it. We do have to go to a break. When we come back, more with Senator Angus King. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Central Maine Heart and Vascular Institute, offering minimally invasive heart and vascular surgery. CMHVI.org.
In southwest Pennsylvania's coal country, a father and daughter are having a culture war in their living room. She's a climate activist, and him?
I can't see it. I don't believe it. Things rising up and eating our atmosphere.
One thing they agree on, bringing jobs back to their hometown. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up in our 2 o'clock public affairs hour in about 20 minutes, Intelligence Squared, an Oxford-style debate asking the following question. Should we give Trump a chance? Again, that's coming up in 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock public affairs hour here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Senator Angus King with us from our nation's capital. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number 1-800-399-3566. I want to note that we have dozens and dozens of questions, and I apologize that we will not be able to get to them all, and probably not even a fraction of them. But we're trying to go to a sort of a nice cross-section to be able to ask the senator a variety of questions. Senator King, this is from Matt on Facebook. He is asking a question about something I know you care a great deal about. He writes, one of the greatest challenges facing rural Maine is the lack of decent broadband. He says, with the Trump administration having promised infrastructure investment, what is the chance of a bipartisan push to improve rural broadband? Is the Rural Electrification Agency of the New Deal a practical model that could be replicated to keep us from falling farther and farther behind?
The answer to his questions are yes, yes, and yes. Rural broadband is a huge issue, number one. Number two, everybody that's talking about infrastructure, including Mr. Trump, as far as I've been able to learn, is talking about broadband as part of that. And yes, I think the rural electrification program of the 30s is very analogous. It's one of my very highest priorities. In fact, a couple of months ago, Shelley Capito, who's a Republican senator from West Virginia, and I started the Rural Broadband Caucus here in the Senate. We've had two or three open sessions. We've had panel discussions. We've now got, I don't know, probably 20 senators involved. It is a huge issue for Maine because it's a real barrier to economic development. If you can't get broadband in a town, you're not going to be able to attract a business. You're not even going to be able to keep your young people living there. I mean, can you imagine looking at a house and a realtor says, well, by the way, you can never get broadband. That's like saying, by the way, you can't get water here. So we're working it from all angles. I have a young man working with me, Adam Lackman, who does this pretty much full time, working with state officials and federal officials and the FCC, all the different ways that we can find to strengthen and improve the broadband situation in Maine. It's a big deal. By the way, we also need more coverage on for cellular service. I drive around Maine all the time, and there are areas where you can't even make a call, and that's unacceptable as well. I met with one of the cellular carriers yesterday talking about that. So the answer is yes. I'm pretty sure it's in the Trump plan. I know it's in the plan that Chuck Schumer has brought up because I insisted that it be there, and he said it is. So I think everybody's talking about it, and there are enough. It's a bipartisan issue. There are enough people, Republicans and Democrats, representing states that have big rural populations. So this is something hopefully we're going to be able to attend to.
Okay, we're going to head up to Caribou and Larry. Larry, you're on Maine Calling with Senator Angus King.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone.
Go ahead.
Okay, I have two points to make, Senator.
First of all, we had a rigged election for president. The Democratic National Committee rigged the primaries in favor of Hillary Clinton. That's the first point I want to make. The second point is that from 1991 to 2014, the United States government invested $5 billion in Ukraine. And what we got was a coup d'etat. So when we talk about Russian influence in elections, we should also talk about American influence in elections. And I think that the Democratic National Committee, Schultz Wasserman should be investigated. That whole thing should be investigated. It was a rigged election.
Okay, Larry, I'm going to give the senator a chance to respond.
Well, if there were actual efforts made that changed the results of votes and were, whatever the definition of rig is, but if that's the case, it should be. I know she lost her job. She was or resigned or was fired shortly after some of that information became public. As far as the Ukraine is concerned, we're active around the world. But to say that our efforts to promote democracy are equivalent to the Russians' efforts to undermine democracy, I'm not sure are the same. I resist saying that those two are equivalent. What happened in our election in terms of the Russian involvement was unprecedented. Not only were they involved in the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and then releasing the information and emails over the course of several months, they also attempted they did hack into a number of state election systems. Fortunately, it appears that it didn't work, that they weren't able to manipulate either registration lists or actual voting, but they weren't doing it for fun, and we have to be careful that that doesn't continue in the future. We were fortunate, actually, that our election system is so decentralized by state and region and city and township and county that it's very hard for somebody to manipulate it, and perhaps that's what the Russians found. But I think, our work trying to promote democracy in other parts of the world, I don't think is the same as these folks coming in and manifestly trying to undermine our electoral process.
Larry, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Waterville and Gerard. Hi, Gerard. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much, Jennifer, for taking my call. This is going to be a bit lighter than the last caller, so you can just probably take a breath. But Senator King, I kind of go along with James that called a bit ago and wish you'd take a stab at the White House. But having said that, I think that we here in Maine should be very proud of the people we send to Washington, and you're at the top of the list. I love your thoughtfulness, your clear-headedness, just the common-sense approach. And that's really all I wanted to say. Oh, and yeah, Jennifer, once again, thank you. I love you. I love this show.
Well, you're welcome, Gerard.
Just for the record, Gerard, we're not related, right? I really appreciate
I do have one comment. I had the honor of actually meeting you at a restaurant in Portland as we both went to the James Taylor concert. I noticed you were a couple of seats ahead of me at the concert. But anyway, thanks so much for your work. I've been in medicine for close to 40 years now, although I started when I was 2. absolute mess that we have here, to just get people taken care of.
What we're doing.
Costs. It takes about 5 people to get a patient to somebody that actually takes care of them. And you're talking about health.
And that's really, we've really got to get on that. Well, thanks for your comment. I got to tell you, it's daunting. And when I was running in 2012, of course, I realized I was running for Olympia Snowe's seat, which she had held. But then I suddenly realized, wait a minute, this is Ed Muskie and George Mitchell's seat. And in fact, I have Muskie's desk in my office. And I often talk to George, but Maine has had a great record of sending terrific people to Washington, Margaret Chase Smith, Bill Cohen, Bill Hathaway, and now Susan Collins. I'm just humbled to be even within sniffing distance of that legacy. So I'm doing my best. Call them as I see them, and that's what I'll keep doing.
Gerard, thanks for your call. We have a more specific email from James. What can you do to reduce student loan debt? It seems to me as a country we promote higher education, and then we put all this debt on our young people.
Well, it's a real problem, and there are sort of two levels. One is the cost of higher ed itself. It's too expensive, and it really has gotten out of hand just in the last 15 or 20 years. It's gone. It used to be, I remember, Jennifer, doing a Maine Watch show in the 80s on student loans, and the head of financial aid at Bates said, the cost of a four-year private college is always the same as a new Ford. And that was interesting because at that time, a new Ford cost about $15,000, and that's what it cost to go to a private college. And now a new Ford is $15,000 or $18,000, maybe $20,000, maybe $25,000 for a good one. But a private college is $60,000. So what happened? How did that – so I think one of the things we have to be looking at is the cost itself and how that can be brought under control both in the private and the public sector. Secondly, the student loan process, one of the things that I believe is that students need to have a clearer idea of what they're getting into. If you sign up, you know, and of course everybody knows that you tend to make commitments and not really take them seriously because they're off in the future. But I think there needs to be more counseling about, are there ways you can do this more cheaply without going into debt that's going to burden you? The final piece was, and it's one of the things that I worked on when I first got here, was the rate of interest. When I got here, the law was that in July of 2013, interest rates were going to double on student loans. We managed to get a compromise through on both sides. There were six of us that led that, four former governors, by the way, bipartisan group. We persuaded our colleagues to do a compromise that ended up cutting that rate in half, and it saved students billions of dollars. So it's one of those problems where there's no simple single solution, but it is as the caller or as the writer suggests, it's a significant problem. It's a drag on our economy. You can come out of college and you have what amounts to a mortgage, but no house. And it affects your job opportunities. So we're trying to simplify repayment and have some forgiven on repayment if you take public service jobs. So a lot of aspects to it. But he's right. It's a major problem.
We'll go up to Booth Bay Harbor and Sean. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hello. I just wanted to ask Senator King about H.R. 708. Basically, it's an age tax that will allow health insurance companies to charge older Americans up to five times more on their insurance premiums than other people. I just wondered if he could address that issue.
I really can't because I'm not familiar with that bill, and that's one that I don't have the background on. So every now and then I have to be honest and say I don't know. I will find out. And by the way, anybody that's calling in or that doesn't get through, you can always write to my office here in Washington, or we have offices in Scarborough, Augusta, Bangor, Presque Isle. You can go by the offices or write or call those offices. It's all on the website, king.senate.gov. And I hope this caller will send the question in, and I'll look at that bill and try to get back to you because I'm I don't know enough. I know something about the issue, but I don't know enough to give you a really good answer.
Thanks, Sean, for your question. An email from, from John here. President Trump just said that he inherited a mess. Can you respond to that charge?
Well, I don't know exactly what he's referring to, so it's hard to respond. Every president, you always look back and say, this isn't my problem. This came before me. If you compare what he inherited to what President Obama walked into, there's really no comparison. The month that President Obama was inaugurated, this nation lost 790,000 jobs in one month. And now we're, for the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, we've been gaining 200,000 jobs a month. So the economy was absolutely in free fall when he came into office. The automobile industry was flat on its back, and we were in real serious danger of losing that almost entirely. So, you know, you can always say, I mean, there never is a shortage of problems, but to imply that somehow things are worse now than they were 8 years ago or 16 years ago. I mean, George W. Bush came in and the first year of his presidency had to deal with September 11th. So that's just part of the reality. I don't know what President Trump was referring to. The world is very dangerous. There's no doubt about that. But I don't know if you can imply. I don't know if he may not have been implying that all this was President Obama's fault. I didn't hear the quote. But it's certainly a dangerous and complex world. There's no doubt of that whatsoever.
So we'll end here with an email from Patrick. Patrick writes, many of us hope that a bipartisan group of senators will form a firewall against radical swings of policy. What is your current assessment of the likelihood that such a group can form, and what can we as citizens do to support your efforts?
Well, such a group did form in 2013 when there was the shutdown. Susan Collins called it the Common Sense Caucus, and we met in her office pretty much every day. There were about, I think, 12 maybe or 14 from both parties, plus me, the odd man out. But I think that's a good idea, and it's one that is on people's minds, but it has to be bipartisan. And one of the things that has been sort of frustrating to me in all of these nominations is that some of them I think were really not good, and the fact that they were passed on party line votes I think was somewhat disappointing. On the other hand, the Secretary of Labor nominee was withdrawn yesterday because of a number of Republicans stepping up and saying, we're not going to vote for this guy. And so they withdrew the nomination rather than have a loss on the floor of the Senate. So there is life in bipartisanship, and certainly that's a major part of my mission down here, is to try to find ways that we can bring people together. And it does work. It's hard to make it work on some of these big controversial issues, but we're getting a lot of things done sort of out of the public eye that I think are making a contribution. But the writer is absolutely right. That's got to be part of what we try to do. It's certainly what I try to do every day.
Senator King, Jennifer, I have to say thank you. We have 10 seconds left.
I was going to – all I wanted to do is say thank you very much, and thanks for – this is a great service to the people of Maine. Thanks for giving me a chance to join you.
Of course. Senator Angus King, I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling.